Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And welcome, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A brand new week, a brand new day. What an extraordinary country. Alex Epstein is with us. He is a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. The I don't even want to call it conservative. The institute that is carrying the flame of Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged, which is, many would say, the intellectual basis of much of what is considered today the modern neoconservative and conservative movement. And although you guys disavow that, I realize. Alex Epstein, welcome to the program. Hey, Alex?
Yes.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
Greetings.
Can you hear me?
Greetings. Yeah, I can. I can hear you now. AynRand.org is the website, by the way, AynRand.org. And welcome to the program. Alex, you wanted to talk about Hillary care, as it were, Hillary Clinton's version of John Edwards' health care plan is how I would characterize it. You guys think this is a terrible thing. I'm wondering, how much do you think William McGuire, the former CEO of United Healthcare, or the United Health Group, who took home $1.7 billion in compensation, how much should he be able to profit off our cancer, off your cancer or heart disease?
Well, as much as he can make in a free market, which would mean as much as he can make by offering the best cancer treatments at the best price. I think it's important to recognize with someone like McGuire's compensation, I don't know the first thing about McGuire, so I have no opinion about him personally, but that the system we have today is not a market system. So however much a person should be able to make in any market, healthcare or not, should be determined by the market. But when you have a semi-socialist, semi-fascist, and I use that word deliberately, healthcare system, then things get totally out of whack and the costs skyrocket and every individual's cost is passed on to everyone else and you get kind of outrageous costs for everything, the kind that never exist in a free market. I mean, they never exist for flat screen TVs, never even exist for elective procedures like laser eye surgery, which are not declared a right by the government and thus controlled by the government. So,
You're calling it that because and you're calling it socialist and fascist because the government is offering healthcare services through Medicaid, Medicare, and that kind of thing, I'm assuming. And which raises the question, if you had a totally what you call free market, that is a market completely controlled by corporate forces, pretty much, I mean, to a certain extent, we're there. Back in 83, when Hillary was proposing her program, her initial program, which was, you know, still, there's plenty of room for the health insurance companies in there, they ran these Harry and Louise ads saying, you're not going to be able to pick your doctor if Hillary has her way. Well, today, if you have health insurance with an HMO or a health insurance company, by and large, odds are you can't pick your doctor. Ultimately, it comes down to, do we want our health insurance to be provided by for-profit corporations that are skimming money off the top and are making decisions based on what's most profitable, or do we want it provided by a public entity that's answerable to we the people, that has as its first goal of operation providing health care rather than making a profit?
We want neither of what you're talking about, but let's start off with, I think you mean 1993, not 1983 in terms of...
93, you're right, yeah, thank you.
In these Harry and Louise heads. But you mentioned... right before then, that what I objected to, and you're absolutely right, is Medicare, Medicaid, and you can add in government-encouraged employer health insurance, which totally institutes a whole third-party payer system where everyone pays for everyone else's health care. So the whole idea of should our health insurance be provided by the government or should it be provided by private corporations, the whole system is out of whack. There's no reason in the world why why people have insurance for something that's for normal health care expenses. What you have insurance for is catastrophic things, and then those are set according to your risk profile in a free market. But with this whole idea that...
Wait a minute, though. If you don't take care of the normal things, if you don't have regular checkups, then you are going to have catastrophic disasters.
Which is part of the destructive effects of government health care. It tells people that, well, no matter what you do, we're going to take care of you. So I'm a pretty young adult. I realize that I'm responsible for my own health care, so I make sure to stay healthy now so that later I don't run up a gigantic health bill. And that's the
But to the contrary, what you have is, in most government health care systems, you have the government encouraging, and in some cases specifically requiring, if you want to get lower premiums on your health insurance, that you have regular checkups, just like some dentists do, some dental plans do.
Right, and that kind of, I mean, that is destructive in its own right. What you need is you need individuals who are free to judge the evidence and see what are the best preventative procedures, what are the costs and benefits, what are the best nutritional guidelines, what are the best exercise procedures. And when that's dictated by the government.
So we all need to go to medical school.
The food pyramid did incalculable destruction to American nutrition because it was just based on false information and everyone.
But it was promoted by corporations. The original food pyramid concept was developed by corporations.
It doesn't
matter.
Sold
to the government.
Everything that emanates from a corporation, I do not give a blessing to. If it emanates from a corporation and the government imposes it by force, it's destructive. It's bad. Period. I mean, the whole HMO system is whole government.
So let's say that we have absolutely no government involvement in healthcare whatsoever.
Okay, great.
Tomorrow we could wipe the slate, and we end up with and we have a totally laissez-faire system with nothing like the Sherman Antitrust Act that prevents corporations from getting too large. So we end up with three healthcare companies, health insurance companies that are basically controlling all of the healthcare in the United States, and they say to you, you must go to this doctor, you must pay this copay, you must pay this monthly amount. They have an absolute monopoly. You have no problem with that.
You just set up a completely fictional scenario, let's say.
Going all the way back to the British East India Company is what happens every time you have unrestrained, unregulated, laissez-faire capitalism.
I would love to do another interview sometime on antitrust and your misconceptions about the history of it and the nature of it, but let's just look at that scenario. Okay, you say control, and I think this gets to the lie of the idea that these companies have control. If these companies are three big companies are providing a service that's unacceptable to us, guess what? People can become doctors. Doctors wouldn't want to work on it under it, first of all, and patients wouldn't want to pay for it. So they'd start their own companies. This is what happens under freedom. Corporation can't control you except that it can provide you a valuable service at a price.
Then why is it that right?
Otherwise,
why is it that? Well, you know, yeah, in the best of all possible worlds, but the fact
no,
of the matter is
reality,
that if you have three corporations that are so – no, it's like try and develop an operating system and compete with Microsoft. You know, it ain't going to happen. I mean, once a company gets so large that it's a monopoly, try to develop an oil company and compete with ExxonMobil. Once a corporation reaches that monopoly stage, no competitor is going to come along with any cogency. It's going to require a major shift in technology or a major shift. You know, some external force is going to create the opportunity for it. It's not going to be simply, hey, here I am.
Well, the
and right now you've got the majority of Americans saying, hey, what's this deal about if I have, you know, if I'm diagnosed with heart disease at this job and I go to job A and I quit and I go to job B, my new health care provider says, oh, we'll cover everything except your heart disease.
Okay.
This is the free market.
Okay, well, Tom, you like to say I'm not allowed to filibuster you, so you can't filibuster me either.
Fair trade.
Okay, so you made so many points, I forgot which ones you made. So what was the first one about antitrust?
Well, is you know, as I said, going all the way back to the British East India Company, antitrust is a reality.
To compete, the harder it is to compete, as far as I'm concerned, the better, because that means that the greater established value that someone is creating. So let's take Microsoft. Everyone's always bitching about Microsoft. People are complaining about it. But why is it so hard? Why was it so hard, especially before, to compete with Microsoft? Well, because they had established this entire framework of value with a standardized operating system and standardized programs that made it very, very easy for us to exchange documents, to use the same programs, to have this interoperability. Now, this has been superseded in some ways by the Internet, which also offers that platform, which is why Microsoft doesn't have as much dominance anymore. But insofar as it did, it was a great thing. So the point is, someone would have to create something unbelievable to beat that. As against an industry where any Joe off the street can compete, that means it's not a very...
But they did it, you know, as this is why the European Union is suing them over their media player. They did it by every time some small company came along and said, oh, I've got a great idea for an application that can run on Windows. Windows said, okay, great, we'll just develop that ourselves and put you out of business. And just the same way that John Rockefeller put all kinds of small oil companies out of business.
Well, I'm writing an essay on Rockefeller, so I'd love to talk about him sometime. But I think it was great that he put those oil companies out of business. If you look at this.
Yeah, so monopolies rule.
It looks like we're out of time, so we'll have to resume the phone.
We'll have to continue this conversation another time. Yeah, Alex, thanks a lot for coming on, though.
All right.
Alex Epstein with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, the website. 16 minutes past. Thanks, Alex. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C.? So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
Hey. Or you can hop on a plane and go to Bangkok. This is how weird it's getting, and which also ties into the collapsing dollar. But it's like we're outsourcing everything. I know people who are going into nursing right now in the hopes of having a decent job, only to discover that H-1B visas are being used to import largely Filipinos into the United States, or Filipinos, I guess, being a Spanish country, speaking country, into the United States as nurses who are willing to work for $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 a year, $30,000 a year, instead of the $35,000 to $60,000 or more that a U.S. nurse would make. In addition to that, Kiplinger is reporting. I mean, this is how incredibly dysfunctional our healthcare system has become. Kiplinger is reporting over on their website, Kiplinger.com. A growing number of patients head overseas for more serious procedures such as hip replacements, heart bypasses, and kidney transplants. They say it's not unusual to save 80%. Why? Well, because the dollar is strong relative to a lot of these countries are poor relative to the United States. And now the health insurance companies are getting in on the act. Two insurers have plans that include access to Bum Run Grod International Hospital in Bangkok, Thailand. One of them is the insurance group OptiMed Health /United Group. They offer Bum Run Grod Hospital in their PPO network. You can get over there, they'll pay for it. Kidney transplant in the U.S., $65,000. You go to Bum Run Grod, it's $20,000. Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina also offering care at Bum Run Grod. So we're seeing the offshoring and outsourcing of our health care, of our health insurance. U.S. insurance firms doing this. Ultimately, this is not going to stand. And what I find most fascinating is that the Financial Times of London, we spent a good chunk of the weekend down in San Diego with a dear friend who is from the United Kingdom. And he was like, you know, even the conservatives in Europe believe that everybody should have health care. You know, it's like, what's wrong with Americans? Well, here's the head. This is the head or the lead editorial, not an op-ed piece by a guest. This is the lead editorial in today's edition, Monday, October 1st, 2007, today's edition of the Financial Times of London, the conservative, kind of the London equivalent of the Wall Street Journal. It starts right out. "For years, foreigners have struggled to understand how the U.S., the most productive country in the world, can fail to offer its citizens what is taken for granted in every other rich economy, universal health insurance. Increasingly, Americans are asking the same question. The country's mood on health care is shifting, and the next administration in Congress will probably do something about it. And then they go on to point out one sign of this and how isolated and of how isolated the Bush administration has become on the subject is the debate over expanding the state children's health insurance program. And it's just, you know, just a very straightforward process there. Now, at the same time, the dollar is starting to collapse. And as the dollar is collapsing, you know, it's going to become a little more expensive to go overseas and get health care. It's going to become actually a lot more expensive, and you're going to have to, and it's going to be progressively more and more third world countries that are offering health care. And at what point do we say, hey, wait a minute. We should be able to take care of ourselves. We should be able to build bombers here if we have to build bombers here. We, by and large, don't. That is, we can't even make a cruise missile right now without chips from China, a country that has already threatened to nuke us. From communist China, not Taiwan. We have seen, over the last 30 years, average decade by decade growth of the economy. During the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, averaged around 3% annually. Decade by decade. Since Ronald Reagan came into office and put into place what is sometimes referred to as neoliberal economics or conservative economics or Reaganomics or whatever you, corporatist economics, fascistic, whatever you want to call it. Since Reagan ended the New Deal and began, you know, basically gutting that thing.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Thank you, Rush. Since that time, in the decades since 1980, the decade of 1980, 1990, and now the decade of 2000, we are finding that annual growth is averaging a little under 2%, 1.7 to 1.9%. Greenspan's policies, Milton Friedman's policies, Tom Friedman's policies, right across the board, Republican policies, conservative economics, whether it has to do with health care, whether it has to do with trade, whether it has to do with taxation, whether it has to do with industrial policy, right across the board, all of it has been shown to be an abject failure, and we're seeing the destruction of the middle class and the destruction of health care as a result.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Don't think of buying from Canada. Oh, we will not play nice. We wrote the new legislation forcing the nation to pay the top price. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow. Yes, you get medication if you join our HMO. There's no more Medicare. Oh, you'll just have to trust us while we're making Medicare go bust.
34 minutes past the hour. Strange stuff, by the way, going on out there. I mean, really strange stuff. Yeah, I was going, flying through San Francisco and San Diego this weekend. I'm sorry, I can't use an airport men's room now without thinking of Larry Craig. And apparently, neither can anybody in Minneapolis. Because in the Minneapolis airports now, they are dropping the stall dividers down to just 2 to 3 inches above the floor. What, they think that's going to stop Larry Craig from passing his business card underneath or something? I don't know. I don't think so. The airport has, by the way, more than 80 bathrooms. They say, however, there are two that are most problematic in terms of complaints. I wonder if there's like a web directory. I'll bet there is out there someplace. Anyway, and Larry Craig, of course, saying, well, he's going to stick around. He's going to stay in Congress. And the Republicans are saying to him, okay, you're going to stay in Congress. You're going to stay in the United States Senate. We are going to launch an ethics inquiry and essentially humiliate. They're threatening Larry Craig. They're going to totally humiliate him. Anyhow, health insurance. I'm curious also what you think about the various plans of the various candidates. And the most specific I would say so far have been Dennis Kucinich, of course, who right from the get-go and for years, actually, has been saying, let's just say Medicare for all, period. Put the health insurance companies out of business next week. John Edwards' plan, more nuanced, more detailed, but one of the big pieces of it is that it would allow any American to buy into Medicare. Medicare, of course, operating with a 3% overhead cost, is always going to be able to trash the for-profit health insurance companies that have to pay their CEOs hundreds of millions of dollars and have to pay their shareholders their 10% dividends and have to pay for the corporate jets and the fancy headquarters and the advertising and everything. And so what Edwards' plan would do is, over a period of probably a few years, ultimately the government would outcompete all the private health insurance companies, and we'd end up with what Kucinich had in mind. And then there's Hillary's plan, which I spent about an hour with this morning reading, and she has the ability to buy into a limited Medicare-like option. And I haven't been able to find the details of that, but I don't think that she's saying anybody can buy into Medicare. Instead, she's got some sort of an analog to it, and it may well be, you know, one of those things that a corporation is providing. I just don't know. But that's her program is quite specific. Many of the same components as John Edwards. In fact, his comment was that he's flattered that, you know, it took her a year, but that she finally came around to his plan. And Barack Obama has a health care plan that's out there and pretty straightforward, although it's a lot vaguer, frankly, and from looking it over than Hillary's or John Edwards. But there's a broad consensus. The bottom line, there's a broad consensus among the leading candidates. I'm not familiar with any detailed health care plans from Chris Dodd or Joe Biden or Mike Gravel. I'm sure they're out there. But, you know, broadly speaking, health care reform is going to come in the United States. The question is just, to what extent are the big health insurance companies going to shape the debate? To what extent are they going to frame this thing? And I think that Bush's veto of the, if he does it, of the state child health insurance program, the SCHIP program that has just passed Congress, is going to be a watershed. I really do. I think it's going to wake up a lot of Americans, and I think it's going to help the Democrats tremendously, which has got the Republicans very concerned, which is why so many Republicans voted for this thing. So in that context, I would say what we are looking at in Bush's veto and the blowback from it is the end of, or the beginning of the end, of neoliberalism in the United States, regardless of who the Democratic candidate is and nominee is. This country is moving progressive, and ain't nothing going to stop it. The pendulum is swinging back. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. And if you'd like to participate in the blog over at Air America, airamerica.com, and click on my name, and it'll take you to the Tom Hartmann page there. Dan in Gaylord, Michigan. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your show. It's really a breath of fresh air, and I really enjoy listening to it. I try to catch as much as I can. I hear these guys, these Ayn Rand guys, and a lot of these free market people on your show. And one thing that really bothers me about them is they want a nice, stable society where they can make as much money as possible. But they don't want to pay for the things that make it a stable society, things like Social Security, things like Medicare, things like national health care, welfare. I mean, if Alex Epstein lives in an apartment in New York City and we didn't have Social Security or welfare, he might get stuck up tomorrow on the on the way to work and not have any money left. And
yeah.
It's the social programs that keep society profitable for for people to make money.
Well, and in fact, it even goes beyond that. There was a fascinating article in either the Financial Times or Wall Street Journal over the weekend. I read it in the airport in San Francisco as we were changing planes and waiting for our plane. And in one of those two weekends, Saturday papers, about how they added up, they took the gross domestic product of a couple of countries, as I recall, seven or eight countries, added up all the market values of all the corporations, added up the estimated value of all the small private companies and all the people who are doing business even in an underground economy. You know, I mean, because it all has to do with circulating cash, you know, the people who are the underground economy from the kid who mows your lawn to the drug dealer down the street. Added all that up, and what they came up with was a number that still represented only about 30% of the actual wealth of the nation. And they were like, you know, where's all the rest of the wealth? Turns out it's the public and civil institutions. It's not just the cost of like teachers in the public schools. It's like the wealth of the nation to a large extent, the ability of a nation to maintain and sustain things like business or hospitals or physicians' offices, whatever, is it requires this huge infrastructure from an educated populace to public roads, to police, to fire. I mean, we talk about it requires the commons. And the commons is a larger chunk of the wealth of pretty much any nation than is all this other stuff. And the conservatives ignore the commons. They think that the commons should become privatized. They want to do away with the commons. And we've seen this now for 26 years. And the result of it is bridges that are failing, schools that are crumbling, roads that are being sold off, you know, the commons being sold off, an air traffic control system in crisis, and on and on and on it goes. And it, you're absolutely right. It's a, the conservatives say that they want a stable society, but Dan, I would submit to you that the way that they want that stability to come about is by creating a nation through trickle-down economics, creating a nation of peons so that they basically have a stable overlord society. Because that's how it worked in the Victorian-era England that Charles Dickens wrote about, his dad having been thrown into debtor's prison, you know, the Scrooge and Marley world. Dan, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. It's a good point and well made. George in Los Angeles. Hey, George.
Hi, how are you?
Or Georgia, I'm sorry.
Yes, Georgia, yes. I wanted to comment on what Alex and Ayn Rand said. I think, you know, most people, reasonable people, agree on the pros and cons of a free market economy. However, in the case of applying it to healthcare, here's a problem that I see. If the medical provider's service got to be subpar, the damage to the patient's health is irreparable. It's done. So you just go out, buy a new piece of software, like with the Microsoft, you know, analogy.
Yep.
You can't undo it if they're subpar.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and also, if you're having a heart attack, you're not going to have the time to go through the phone book and call five different ambulance services and get the lowest price and call 15 different hospitals and compare their doctors. I mean, it's a whole different thing. This has to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those core issues that really are the province of the commons, of we the people. And the biggest, the most important part of the commons, of course, is government. The thing that we all collectively own that is supposed to administer all the rest of the commons. So, good point and well made, Georgia. Thank you very much. Anthony in Stockton, California.
Hi, Tom. I'm the second time I'm calling your show. I love you invite crackpots on your show to discuss their side of the story from the conservative.
Well, here's the scary part, Anthony. Alex doesn't represent, I mean, you know, we may think he's a crackpot, or you may, but he doesn't represent a lunatic fringe perspective. He reflects a worldview that has been adopted in large part as the result of the rise in the 60s and 70s of these think tanks like the Heritage Institute and the Cato Institute. He represents a worldview that a lot of people in America agree with.
Oh, well, yeah, it's a surprising amount of Americans agree with his, you know, mindset and his ideology.
That Hillary had to back down in 93.
Yeah, right. You know, the healthcare industry and the pharmaceutical industry spent millions of dollars and tried to defeat her plan, you know, the Clinton Care and stuff I read about on the Sicko webpage and everything. And, you know, and I pay $184 for my health insurance. And, you know, I work in like a kind of menial job and I have no children and no wife or anything like that. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out if my health care is being taken up by a quarter of my paycheck every pay period. You know, what happens if I have children and a wife all of a sudden, you know, what happens to my premiums?
It will go up
by two or three times. I mean, you know, how do I pay for it? And how can people sit there and justify saying, well, you know, I'm a rich guy and I went to college and, you know, and I got the great education and now I'm making a lot of money, but then I shouldn't have to help those below me or those that are
Now, Anthony, your point is really well made. And really, I think the essence of what you're saying is that the ultimate family value, because here you are concerned that if you get married and you have children, you won't be able to afford health care on yourself. The ultimate family value is a national health insurance program. Period. I mean, that's the ultimate family value. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
This Saturday, by the way, at the Washington Green Festival, the Washington, D.C. Convention Center, I'll be speaking at 6 p.m. on the main stage. So if you are showing up, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, and you are going to be showing up at the Washington Green Festival, drop by, say hi. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Robert in Manhattan. Hey, Robert.
How are you, Tom? I enjoy your program. It's, as usual, it's great. I love when you bring this topic up. The thing that is driving me nuts about it, I'm sure other people out there, is the fact that the Democratic leadership and also the candidates running for president don't seem to really understand the full extent of the how the popular people out here are annoyed that they're not addressing this. They always seem to...
Oh, I think they get it. They just don't want to give up hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions, in-kind support from the health insurance companies. It really is. This gets down to, you know, what Bernie Sanders has been talking about on this program for going on five years now, which is public financing of campaigns. We need to get the money out of the campaigns, and then we'll be able to get the money out of the moneyed interests out of our lives.
You're right on target.
It's the absolute.
I wish we knew what we would need to do. Do we have to hit them over the head with the 2x4 so we can get their attention? What is it that needs to be done to get their attention so they start understanding what they have to do to get
them? We need to keep letting them know how upset we are, Robert. You need to show up at their, you know, when they have town meetings, you need to show up. You need to send them faxes. You need to call them. I launched a new website last week called callcongress.org. Callcongress.org. It simply points to a page on my website where I list my best state-of-the-art knowledge. You know, if people all the time are giving me 800 numbers to call Congress, where I list the phone number for Congress and all of the 800 numbers that I know of. And it also says, you know, hey, if you find bad numbers here, send me an email and I'll fix them. Or if you know of numbers, send me and I'll put them up there. And it's just callcongress.org, very simple. And you, not everybody can access it because when a new URL goes live, it sometimes takes a day or two for it, or three, for it to migrate across the web. But most people can check it out. Amy in San Diego listening on KLSD. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. It was great hearing your program this morning with that guy from the Ayn Rand thing. He was saying that we don't need insurance for everyday life. Everything is preventable. He thinks we should live healthy lifestyles so we don't get cancer, or we can prevent all cancers from just living right. That's ridiculous.
Right. We're walking around with 100 different carcinogens in our bloodstream from our environment and our foods, and you could get hit by a car any day, God forbid.
Exactly. That was the next thing I was going to say. It's his unfettered or whatever corporations that can run amok with the environment. It probably is preventable if we rein those people in. That guy was just too much to believe. Thanks for having him on. I love it when you have these guys on and you just smash all their theories to bits. It's just
beautiful. Well, I think it's important that we listen, and we listen seriously,
yes,
because so many people take that perspective seriously, that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton were absolutely unable to get health care passed in 1993. For that matter, Harry Truman was the guy who first proposed Medicare for All, Dennis Kucinich's plan. Harry Truman proposed that in 1947.
Wow,
and in the election of 46, the Republicans took the House and Senate, and they shot it down. Harry Truman was the guy who proposed Medicare for All. They're the equivalent of Medicare for All. Medicare actually didn't come along until Lyndon Johnson. He created it. Patsy in Faircrest, Washington. Hey, Patsy.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I wanted to talk about this health care thing, too. Right now, I'm a retired person. I pay 25% of my income for health care insurance. That doesn't even include pills. Now, what really is bothering me is with all these national things and the radio and the TV and everything, they're not mentioning Kucinich's single-payer health care at all. They're always saying, well, Edwards is the first one to come out with this.
Well, actually, in my description of them just a few minutes ago, I started with Kucinich.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is that I believe that Edwards does have a good plan because he has to kind of work his way into a single-payer system where Dennis just wants to say, let's just get it going.
Yeah, and I, you know, I absolutely agree with Dennis Kucinich. I just don't think that it's politically viable. There's too many people in Congress who are too well supported by the health insurance industry for it to happen. Both Dennis Kucinich and John Edwards are corporate America's and certainly the healthcare industry's worst nightmare. And, you know, that's why they're doing everything they can to marginalize both of them, frankly, in my opinion. But, it's a good starting point. Gary in Middletown, thanks for the call. Gary in Middletown, Connecticut. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Hey, real simple on healthcare. I want what Congress has. Nothing less, maybe more. I want the pensions. I want the health cares. I want every little vacation they get, every time off. If it's good enough for our elected leaders who've raised themselves up to the House of Lords, both Republicans and Democrats, both the Senate and the House of Representatives, they put themselves above everybody now. They think they're the greatest, most incredible people. I want what they have. I don't care. I don't want to hear any more about the free market. I'm so sick of hearing free market, free market, free market. I don't care. Call me a commie. Call me a socialist. I want what Congress has.
Well, wasn't it John Edwards who in the last debate said that when I become president, I am going to put everybody who is a federal an elected federal employee, in other words, all the members of Congress, and myself, on notice that if we don't have a national health care program within 6 months, at the end of 6 months, we're pulling all health care programs for all elected federal employees? I'm quite sure it was John Edwards who said that. And in the debate, I mean, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm quite sure it was. Absolutely. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Debbie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Debbie.
Hi. I just have to be upfront. I haven't read Atlas Shrugged. I tried. It was too depressing. If I'm going to read historical period stuff, I'll read James Michener. But I was listening to you talk to the guy at the Ayn Rand Institute. As a kid, we didn't have health insurance.
So, when were you a kid?
Yeah, I mean, my family and I didn't have any formal health
coverage. Oh, you mean your family didn't have health insurance?
Yeah, if
right.
we went to the hospital, we made arrangements with the hospital. If we didn't have cash, we'd make payments.
Yeah. But see, back in the day, I mean, long ago and far away, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and back then, health care was not that expensive. I mean, it just was not. It didn't cost a fortune to see the doctor, and medical procedures were not as expensive as they are. We're having huge inflation in that area. 57 minutes past the hour. Wesley Clark, up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from New York to Los Angeles, from Seattle to Pittsburgh, and all places in between, from Denver to Detroit, and on and on. Anyhow, welcome back. General Wesley Clark is with us. 4stardemocrats.com, his website. He served in the United States Army for 34 years, rose to the rank of 4-star general as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. As I recall, General Clark, that was the position that Dwight Eisenhower had, was it not?
It is the position. Eisenhower put it together. He had it during World War II as Supreme Commander. He put it together again in 1950-51 as the NATO Supreme Allied Commander. I was number 12 to hold the position after Eisenhower.
That must have been quite an honor.
It was an amazing thing to sit at Eisenhower's desk.
Yeah. You're also the author of best-selling books Waging Modern War and Winning Modern Wars. Your new book, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. Marvelous. Bill Clinton says a powerful story of how the promise of America empowered a young boy to become a man, a soldier, and a hero. It's largely autobiographical, and there's some fascinating pieces in it that I'd like to get into with you. For example, you talk about the Vietnam War, and there's one passage in the book where you note that summer you're talking about, you know, during let's see, which year was this? I'd have to go back a couple
maybe
of pages
68?
To catch the year. I think it was the summer of 68. You said that summer was a crazy time in the Army with the Vietnam War at its peak. Experienced non-commissioned officers were refusing to re-enlist. Serious discipline problems were frequent. One night a soldier from another unit lobbed a Molotov cocktail at the military police station. Another night two soldiers fought a duel with .22 caliber pistols. AWOL offenses as well as drug abuse incidents were rampant, and the Army had just been directed to transition to an all-volunteer force.
It was a crazy time.
Yeah. Now, do you find parallels? I find this interesting. You know, the all-volunteer force versus a draft force, a non-all-volunteer force. First of all, do you find parallels between that army in Vietnam or some dimensions of it and what's going on in Iraq with our military?
What's the amazing thing is that army in Vietnam fought, and the soldiers that were there who didn't want to be there in my company, they saved my life in combat. So I love them, and I admire them, and I'm enormously grateful and will be all my life to them. But we have a different army today. The soldiers in the army today, they want to be there. We don't have those kinds of discipline problems because before you come into the army, they make sure you want to be there.
Thomas Jefferson suggested that if we ever had what he called an army full of men willing to be shot at for a sixpence, that the nation would be at risk of military coup, that military coup was one of the things that had historically brought down governments. What are your thoughts about an all-volunteer army versus an army that is made up of conscripts in addition to people who want to be there, that is more reflective of the broad cross-section of America?
Well, I think the volunteer army is better for the army, but a way of national service is better for America.
Yeah,
and the difference is what's good for America versus what's good for the army. The army, when the army is filled with people who don't want to be there, it becomes coercive. When the army is filled with volunteers, it becomes like a business where people are in there to do the best they can and advance. That's good for the organization. You treat people better. The organization's more competent, more professional. But I think it's a dangerous thing for the country to have an armed forces that's more or less isolated from the mainstream of public opinion. And that's what's happening in America today.
You note in later on in the book that, in fact, here's the quote, you say, "My views have come a long way since I arrived at the Joint Staff in 1994 and handed Sholly that plan for intervention in Rwanda." Some thoughts, first of all, on Rwanda and also on the Balkans that you were involved with and talk about in the book. And how has your thinking come a long way since the mid-90s?
Well, I think that there's a feeling that in the Army, you do what your boss asks you to do. You do it to the best of your ability. If there's a problem, you bring him the problem, but you bring a recommended solution. Fine. Every second lieutenant's taught that, and they eventually learn it. But what happened to me in 1994 is I was asked to produce a plan for military intervention in Rwanda. I brought it to Sholly. Sholly looked at it. There was a lot of political pressure not to do anything. We didn't do anything. And the result was one of the great problems of the Clinton administration is 800,000 to a million people were basically murdered, hacked to death with machetes, shot, mutilated in Rwanda. We could have acted to stop that. And what I learned was to take a larger view of my responsibilities. It's why I urged the commanders in Iraq on a personal basis to not, if the mission is not working and you're the senior man on the ground, don't just keep marching into a wall. You've got to blow the whistle before it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And very well said. General, we're talking with General Wesley Clark. His new book is just out. It's called A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. And it's a fascinating autobiography, a brilliant arc of the history of America, particularly with regard to our military conflicts. General Norman Podhoretz, the godfather of modern neoconservatism, was on this program either last week or late in the week before. And he and I had an exchange that I'd like to play. It's just a 40-second clip for you and get your take on it, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Is that all right? Here it is.
You have said that your plan to bomb Iran would, quote, unleash a wave of anti-Americanism all over the world that will make the anti-Americanism we've experienced so far look like a love fest. Was that a quote out of context, or did you mean it the way it sounds?
Well, it's only out of context in the sense that in making the case for bombing Iran, which I did in the article from which you just quoted, and I also do in my book, I was trying to be give an honest account of the worst-case scenario that might follow from bombing Iran. But I took the position, I take the position that, as Senator McCain once said, the only thing worse than bombing Iran is allowing Iran to get the bomb.
Now, Potharetz is doing the circuit right now and aggressively promoting this idea of our bombing Iran. Apparently, there's a right-wing think tank or group that has been put together to promote this. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I've seen this coming for a long time. As I describe in the book, in 1991, Paul Wolfowitz told me that we only then, he said, Paul Wolfowitz was number three in the Pentagon then, he said we only have 5 to 10 years to use military force to clean up these whole country states in the region, including Iran. And I saw the same policy. I was in the Pentagon in November of 2001, almost 10 years later, and talking to one of the generals on the Joint Staff who just received a memo from the Secretary of Defense's office telling him that, and this is in my book, but telling him that, that we were going after 7 countries in 5 years, including Iran. So when I hear Norm Potteritz talk like that, I say, hey, it's the same old plan. These people never learn anything. You must
what do you think would be the
your interests, well, but you use force only as a last resort. We're so far from that in this case that it doesn't even, I mean, we should be talking to Iran. Ask Norm Potteritz why he's afraid to have a dialogue with Iran. What's he afraid
of? Yeah, well,
of?
I did.
What,
I did, and he said, he and his response was, oh, would you have had a dialogue with Hitler? Chamberlain
absolutely
tried that.
Absolutely, we should have had a dialogue with Hitler. If we'd done it in 32 or 33, we might have saved millions of lives. We could have told Hitler in no uncertain terms he was making a big mistake thinking he could get away with military aggression. And we better tell the Iranians the same thing.
Yeah. What do you think would be the effect if Bush and Cheney have their little bombing fest in Iran? What
hard to determine. There's guys like Potteritz are around stirring up and leading this group. And there's actually some people in Washington who are saying that, well, you only have to bomb 6 or 7 targets and the Iranians, the government will fall because the Iranians like Ahmadinejad have scoffed at the American threat and don't believe America will do it, so they'll be discredited. I think that's a very dangerous line of thought. My guess is it takes 3 to 4 weeks of continuous bombing. At the end of that, if you haven't killed everybody in the Iranian government, they'll be spitting mad at you. The people that were out there as pro-American right now, 60% of the population, they'll fall in line behind their government and we'll have unleashed a long-term continuing conflict in the region that will blend into and deepen the conflict in Iraq and the war on terror. We'll have succeeded in making a big problem a whole lot bigger. But we won't have succeeded in resolving the problem of Iran. And it's more about Iran than it is about Iranian nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
We need
yeah.
to give the Iranians a way out of their dilemma that they've created for themselves. They need to see that there's a better way for Iran to achieve its goals in the modern world of being a respected member of the world community.
General, we have to take a break. I'm wondering if you can stick around for another 6 or 8 minutes or 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
Great. I have a couple more questions here I'd love to get into with you. We're talking with General Wesley Clark. His new book, A Time to Lead, For Duty, Honor, and Country. It's just a marvelous read. General Clark will be right back with us. 1-866-303-2270, our number, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com for our blog and for our live chat room. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you on Air America Radio. We're talking with General Wesley Clark, his new book, A Time to Lead, For Duty, Honor, and Country. General Clark, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm curious about your take on something that I'm reading on a lot of blogs, and it might just be real way out there, but a lot of these blogs are being put together by ex-military folks about these nuclear missiles that were transported to apparently accidentally a screw-up to Barksdale Air Force Base, which is the staging area for the Middle East. And one of the theories that's being floated is that this is the military pushing back against the civilian command, against the Bush administration, by leaking the fact that these nukes had been moved, essentially saying, you know, we're not happy about the fact that you guys are planning on bombing Iran. You have any thoughts on that?
not, it's not, that cannot be correct. The military doesn't push back like that. The military wouldn't leak that information. Those missiles wouldn't have been moved that way unless there had been a mistake. No. This is a screw-up inside the armed forces chain of command over the nuclear weapons and the accountability and how they're moved and how they're managed. This is a big mistake.
Yeah, okay, interesting. And I'm curious about your take on the presence of what some are referring to as mercenary forces, others, you know, auxiliary security forces and whatnot, Blackwater and company, they're one of many in Iraq.
Well, there's a lot of great people in those organizations. They're making a living and, you know, they're doing what the market is there for them to do. But if it were my policy to run, I wouldn't have organizations like that in country. I think they're an unacceptable risk to the accomplishment of the mission. When you go to war, all of the use of force is supposed to be under the authority of law, under the authority of the commander in chief, and ultimately, you can't control these civilian organizations like Blackwater. You just don't. If you had all of the means to control them, then you wouldn't need them. They're an expensive shortcut, but the shortcut is a shortcut to failure. You can't win the hearts and minds if you don't have really tight grip over the rules of engagement. And in this case, because we don't have enough soldiers, because we don't have enough State Department uniform security people there, we've gone to contractors, and it's an expensive solution, and ultimately it's a failing solution.
We're talking with General Wesley Clark, his new book, A Time to Lead. General Clark, you've endorsed Hillary Clinton, if my recollection is correct.
Yes, I have.
And you have said that if she were to pick you for vice president right now, it's way too early to comment on whether you would be interested in that or not.
Well, it's way too early for her to pick me.
Sure. And you haven't, but you haven't, certainly haven't ruled it out. I'm wondering if you would similarly not rule out being vice president for any of the other candidates should one of them become nominated.
Well, I haven't ruled out anything, but I'm not, I didn't do this to sort of be in the political mix and the political game. I'm in the private sector. I was really honored to have run. A lot of people have listened to me inside the Democratic Party, and people who are on the outside ask me my opinion. I wanted to try to help shape the outcome of this year's race by endorsing the person I felt to be best qualified. That's all. It was about the country, and it's about this race for the presidency. It's not about me.
Well, there's a lot of people out there who are great Wes Clark, political Wes Clark fans who call into this program on a fairly regular basis.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're well aware of that. Sir, what's the A Time to Lead, the book, General Wesley K. Clark, our guest. What is the essence of your book, if you could capture it in a minute or so?
It's a story about what is America through a series of episodes as a modern American lives through his life. It's the desegregated South and the beginnings of white anger. It's young men who fight in a war they didn't volunteer to serve in, but fight well. It's a nation struggling to adapt to a new strategy after it wins the Cold War. It's a nation that's viewed with extraordinary respect by those abroad. It's the wonder of America. We're a modern-day miracle. We've got an incredible opportunity to shape the future of the history of mankind if we just recognize who we are. And America, who we are, that's what this book is about.
Yeah, I think you would agree we've gone a little off the rails recently.
Well, I certainly haven't supported the direction of the policies by the Bush administration in Iraq.
Yeah, we have a little less than a minute left, sir. What do you think is the real state of our military right now, and what should be done?
I think there's great men and women serving. I think, you know, they feel like they're under tremendous stress. They're isolated. The country's not sacrificing along with the military. We need more people in uniform. But I think they're very loyal. They're very capable. They're very proud, and we're darn lucky to have them.
Is the military broken?
No. It's not broken, but it's like anything that when you've worked an organization so hard, you've lost some fundamental skills, you've got a lot of equipment that needs to be repaired, you've got a lot of family relationships that need time to heal. We need to get back and give ourselves a time to learn from this and rebuild the organization. But broken? Absolutely not. No one should ever believe that.
Yeah, and if we go into Iran, we're not going to get that breathing space, are we?
No, but if we go into Iran, it's going to have to be under political authority that really takes a much broader view of its responsibilities than what we've seen in Iraq. That's why I'm saying we need to be dialoguing with the Iranians first. That's
very,
the essential requirement.
Well,
talk to these people.
Wesley Clark, the book A Time to Lead. Sir, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, the Chicken Hawks are out in full force. John Bolton, Chicken Hawk John Bolton out there calling for the bombing of Iran immediately. The Sunday Telegraph, the British newspaper, one of the three largest British newspapers, says yesterday, quote, the American Air Force is working with military leaders in the Gulf to train and prepare Arab air forces for a possible war with Iran. The Sunday Telegraph can reveal. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has just given Blackwater another $92 million. Isn't that happy-making? And in The New Yorker, Seymour Hersh writing about the administration's plans for Iran. He says there's three significant developments. That all of this reflects. He says, first, the president and his senior advisors have concluded that their campaign to convince the American public that Iran poses an imminent nuclear danger has failed. Now, this is different than before we ran up to Iraq. And so they have kind of a plan B. He says, the second development is that the White House has come to terms in private with the general consensus of the American intelligence community that Iran is at least 5 years away from obtaining a bomb. And finally, Iran has emerged as the is emerging as the geopolitical winner in the war with Iraq. Now, you and I would probably draw very different conclusions from that information than the Bushies have. But as Seymour Hersh writes, during a secure video conference that took place early this summer, the president told Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, that he was thinking of hitting Iranian targets across the board and that the British were, quote, on board. In a White House meeting with Cheney this summer, it was agreed that if limited strikes on Iran were carried out, the administration could fend off criticism by arguing that they were a defensive action to save soldiers in Iraq. If Democrats had objected, the administration could say Bill Clinton did the same thing. He conducted limited airstrikes in Afghanistan, the Sudan, and Baghdad to protect American lives. One retired CIA official said they're moving everybody to the Iran desk. They're dragging in a lot of analysts and ramping up everything. It's just like the fall of 2002. And he adds, the guys now running the Iranian program have limited direct experience with Iran. In the event of an attack, how will the Iranians react? They will react, and the administration has not thought it all the way through. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, comes out and says essentially the same thing. He says, we do this, it's going to intensify the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, could draw Pakistan into it. We could be in a regional war for 20 years. But Petraeus is out there promoting the Bush administration's case against Iran. He said, Iran, this is quoting Petraeus, Iran is fighting a proxy war against the Iraqi state and coalition forces in Iraq. At the same time, in Iran, the Shiites in Iran are cutting deals with in Iraq, al-Maliki's government, they're cutting deals with the Iranians. I mean, there's over $1 billion a year worth of trade right now, being done between Iran and Iraq that has nothing to do with military anything. Again, my conversation with Norman Potteritz, one of the lead guys who's out there promoting this. This is from a week or so ago here on this program. Well, according to the IAEA, there's no evidence that there's an Iranian bomb in the offing. They say, and they've been given the International Atomic Energy Commission, the agency of the United Nations. Yeah. They're in there. They have inspectors in there. It's wide open.
Yeah.
And they say that they're enriching uranium up to the 3% more or less level that's necessary to fuel a nuclear reactor, not the 90+% level necessary for a bomb.
Right. But I don't think even the
IAEA. You don't
believe them? No, of course not. And you didn't
believe them before we attacked Iraq either, when they said that there was no nuclear weapons in Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, it was more me talking than him, but you get the point. Anyway, don't confuse me with reality here. We're not going to do that. 1-866-303-2270, Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi. You know, the hearts and minds that were tried to be won by this excursion into Iraq were, I think, more so the hearts and minds of the American people. And by possibly lying to us about all the reasons to go to war in Iraq, we've lost confidence in what we've been told, what we are told. And I think that once bitten, twice shy applies here, in that not just Iran, the possibilities with Iran invasion or bombing, but all possibilities of health care and domestic issues as well. And when the American people are not in their houses or in their jobs, they will even more so be stung or bitten by the realities of the system that we've been.
In fact, I think, you know, Clark made the point that 60% of the Iranian people right now consider themselves pro-American. I've seen numbers much higher than that, frankly. And all we're doing is giving Ahmadinejad and the crazies, the hard right in Iran, all the ammunition that they need. I mean, I don't think that this guy would have been elected. I don't think he would have come to power if Bush had not declared Iran the axis of evil. You had a moderate government, relatively speaking, in Iran before Ahmadinejad came along and before Bush declared them as part of the axis of evil. We need to reclaim our relationship with that country, build on it, and try to bring them slowly into the modern world, much as we're doing with Qatar and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates and arguably to some extent with Saudi Arabia, rather than dropping bombs on them. I'm sorry, there's just, you know, no way that produces a positive outcome. As Clark said, it should be the last resort. Leland in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Leland. Leland, you're on the air.
Tom, this is Leland.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I think that what Wesley Clark had to say about the B-52s overflying the United States of America kind of misses the mark, because under no circumstances, as I understand it, do nuclear-armed B-52s ever go to Barksdale Air Force Base. If you're going to decommission a nuclear weapon, you take them to Kirtland or some other place that actually handles nuclear weapons.
Well, that's why they're saying it was a mistake. That's why they're
mistake. I mean, people. I
agree with you. I agree with you. But, you know, on the other hand, this is a guy who is a four-star general and knows how the military works.
All the other military, informed military opinion is that it's impossible for something like this to happen, because if you have nuclear armed missiles, you have to have extremely, extremely high authority, as well as go through all kinds. I mean, the amount of like protections against moving armed nuclear weapons across the United States of America in violation of all international treaties is huge. A kind of mistake like that it can't be a mistake.
It could conceivably be a mistake if you put it in the context of how totally screwed up the Bush administration has wrecked our military. You know, the folks who should be taking care of this stuff are in Iraq instead of in wherever I mean, you could probably paint a scenario where they've botched things up so badly that it is possible that it's a mistake. But I'm still very, frankly, very skeptical. I'm sorry. I'm not taking General Clark's word for it, although his word does carry a lot of weight. I'll put it in the equation. Lee, is it Lee or Leah in Tampa, Florida? Leah. Hey, Leah.
Hey.
What's up?
I'm calling to say over the air that I think America is turning into a bully.
Because all we're doing is bullying other countries. If other countries were doing this to us, what if China was out there saying, we're going to bomb America? There would be a problem. And the parade can get as big as it wants to now, and the ball is rolling so fast that the parade has become irrelevant. I have called. I've sent money. I've done everything I can. The Democrats don't listen. The Republicans obviously apparently have no brains. They've all melted. And this march to bomb Iran is just, I feel like I'm living in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's deja vu all over again, Leah. Well said. Kevin in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out, or at least one comment, is that in all this time, no one has mentioned the fact that if Iran is, if the premise for going to war with Iran is that they have nuclear weapons or the possibility of nuclear weapons, what about Israel? I mean, it's been well documented that they have well over 100 medium-range nuclear weapons.
Right, but Israel isn't making noises that we might consider to be threatening. You know, Israel's a democracy and they're an ally. Iran is only marginally democracy and definitely not an ally. I don't think that those analogies are parallel. If you want an analogy that may have some cogency, India and Pakistan are both nuclear armed. They're next to each other. They view many people. The hard right in both parties views the other country as the enemy. And there's a problem, although. And Pakistan is not a democracy. It's run by a military junta right now. So, you know, I mean, there's possibly an analogy, but even then, I think you're stretching it. The fact that Israel's nukes aren't being mentioned, it's because it's common knowledge. I mean, it's just, you know, everybody gets it that they're there. So, Alan in Seattle. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed, Tom. I really admire you. I really admire your words. You're a really good man who's very knowledgeable.
So what I do wrong?
To allow Wesley Clark, who's a traitor to this country, who turned Republican, who turned Democrat in 2003, and to give him the kind of lauding that you've given him really upsets me and really makes me decide or choose maybe not to listen to you again. Because the things you say, you back up with your words. But nobody, I mean, Randy.
What did Clark say that so upset you, Alan?
I'm sorry?
What did Clark say that so upset you?
No. It's what Clark is that upsets me, that you allow a man on your show to talk as if he's talking for the good of the American people. This is a guy who first of all, sold caps to Cheney. He's in the bed with all of these boys here. You know, and not only you, but everybody in Air America, Randy Rhodes, and I love her, too. I mean, giving this war criminal credence and to talk about, you know, nuclear arms coming across America as just a mistake, and he knows better because he's a four-star general. You said that yourself just a moment ago. And, you know, we're talking about Israel. We supply nuclear bombs to Israel, and I'm a Jew, by the way, and I'm very upset with that situation.
Yeah,
you know,
I got it, Alan. Alan, I got it. We're out of time. But I got it. And no, I don't think we supplied nuclear weapons to Israel. I think they did it all on their own. But, okay, so you don't like Wesley Clark. That's life. 46 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Listen on my phone. They're sneaking and they're peeking, and I'm never quite alone. They're spying and they're prying, but I shouldn't be alarmed. They're only gonna do it to keep me safe from harm. They call it Homeland Security, so they can do the things they do. But I'm not feeling any safer. How about you?
9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this Friday, or this Saturday, rather, October 6th at 6 p.m., I'll be at the main stage at the Washington Green Festival. On October 26th, I'll be in Seattle signing books at the Elliott Bay Bookstore. And on October 27th, I'll be at Sonoma University with Project Censored. At Project Censored Award, I am sharing the first place prize for Project Sensitive Award this year. Great honor. We're going to go down to Sonoma State University and accept that. So I'll be there all day Saturday. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. Supreme Court did a bad one and a good one today. They said that they're not going to consider the case of a detainee. It was actually the Hamden case at Guantanamo Bay challenging the legality of the military commissions. So essentially they are allowing the military commissions to go on. That means they couldn't get those four votes in order to hear the case.
Wow. If they couldn't get four votes to hear their case, they certainly couldn't get five to overturn the lower court ruling.
Right, but they couldn't
which
even
means,
get four
which
to
means,
hear it.
Right, which means that instead of the detainees in Guantanamo having access to our court system, they're going to be in front of these kangaroo courts where they can't hear what the evidence against them is. Secondhand evidence can be used. They can be convicted on hearsay. They can be put to death on hearsay.
Right. My brother Michael Ratner is, of course, the expert, but he is now in Europe, and so we'll try and get him back on for you on this particular issue.
Please do.
They did a good thing. They are not going to overrule a Ninth Circuit appeals ruling. This was a Faith Center Church Evangelic Ministry. They wanted to use the county library for its worship services. And the Ninth Circuit essentially said, we disagree that anything remotely community-related must therefore be granted access to a library's meeting room. And so the Supreme Court was pretty good on that one. And also, they did reject a request by tobacco companies to consider making it much more difficult for smokers to say they were misled by the industry. This has to do with a Florida case that is called R.J. Reynolds versus Engel.
Right, so this is going to make it harder to sue the tobacco companies. I also understand that they refuse to take a case that where, well, maybe I have that one wrong. I'll have to go back and check on it. So anyhow, what else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Okay, well, of course, what's fascinating is that all the material that they're now putting out, General Petraeus' spokesperson saying about how the casualties are so much less and the civilian deaths, both U.S. military and civilian deaths dropping to the lowest rate in more than a year. Well, another way to look at it is, yes, that may very well be true. But also the insurgency or whatever you want to call them is getting very smart because, as you know, last week there was a meeting of supposedly a reconciliation meeting, and somebody came in to the mosque, and there were Sunnis and Shiites, and essentially blew up another governor and several other people. So
they're targeting the high-level political folks rather than just average guys and the average men and women in the markets and things.
Exactly. I have to give it to our folks at National Journal Congress Daily. They did a wonderful piece today on the actual cost of the Iraq War and what it really is costing us in terms of billions of dollars. Now, the actual cost in terms of the cost is more because, of course, it doesn't take into necessarily, you know, the all overall running in the military. But basically, they have put together an amount with the Congressional Research Service that in the new fiscal year, because there's going to be at least $200 billion more approved, that you're looking at a figure of $800 billion.
Wow. Well, that's easily enough to provide for a national health care system, among other things.
Absolutely. And that is, I mean, that is just, that's an open and shut eye-popping $800 billion. And again, that doesn't include the kinds of stuff that we don't necessarily see.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, now, defense contracting and the defense authorization is going to be hot on the hit parade, and the overall defense bill this year, and that does not include the supplemental, is $459 billion, so $459.3 billion.
Right, and then add almost $200 billion to that for the supplement.
And
right.
Just to add insult to injury, this also gives a 3.5% pay raise for military personnel. That's a half percentage higher than the Bush administration wanted for the military.
And it's also within spitting distance of the rate of inflation. I mean, it's essentially the rate of inflation right now.
That's right.
So it's not a pay raise at all.
And as you know, if you're an enlisted guy, you know, maybe an E4 or E5, and you have a few kids, you're eligible to join food stamps, to get food stamps.
Right, right, which is a sad commentary in the state of affairs with regard to it, the way that we're, quote, supporting the troops, end quote, during, quote, time of war, end quote. I mean, it's just absolutely outrageous. Alan Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Coming up next, Norman Solomon is going to be here. We'll be talking about his new book, Make Love Got War, Made Love Got War, Close Encounters of America's Warfare State. He's also the director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and what they're up to these days. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Norman Solomon is with us, all-around good guy, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and author of a new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters of America's Warfare State, which has been made into and has been adapted to a war called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman Solomon, the website War Made Easy, themovie.org, for example, one of them. But Norman Solomon, also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is accuracy.org. Norman Solomon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you back. We talked just a while ago about the movie War Made Easy, and the book is the inspiration for the movie, or provides the arc for the movie, or what?
Well, really, the book being published today is a sequel to all that in its own entity. Made Love Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, is a freestanding sort of follow-up to War Made Easy. And in this new book, Made Love Got War, I talk about the last 50 years that we will now mark the anniversary of the Sputnik launch of on Thursday. You know, it was exactly 50 years ago, October 4th, when, as I say in the book, the moment was startled by a rocket, the Russians suddenly launching into space. And what I try to do is telescope the last 5 decades. What did the United States do with this tremendous come-from-behind victory in technology in space, somebody in the moon by the end of the 1960s, the reality being that our society have devoted enormous resources to destruction, to a warfare state, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, I remember when Sputnik went up, everybody was in a panic about the thing, and the good news that came out of it was that Eisenhower threw a lot of money into program. He said he wanted to bring up a generation of engineers and scientists, and threw a lot of money into programs for technology and for gifted kids. I was pulled out of my class in the first or second grade, whichever I was at that time. And I guess it was first grade, I was 6 years old, and was able to participate in those fast-track learning programs up to the point where I got a summer scholarship to MSU when I was 14. As a consequence of that, and by the time the Vietnam War came along, they did away with all that funding for education, you know, for the education of the masses.
Yeah.
It had all shifted into the war machine itself, and it's pretty much stayed there ever since.
Well, that is a tremendous irony that education was a huge push in the initial years after Sputnik in this country, and yet nothing has decimated higher education and lower education in this country more than the spending on military purposes, now $2 billion a day into the military. And I think a parallel storyline, the real one, above the and beyond the sort of rah-rah pom-pom cheerleading of the technology race that the U.S. has won, is that we have decimated our own society. And I think we could say not only in terms of infrastructure, bridges falling down, healthcare, education, housing, but also what Martin Luther King called the failure to deal with our moral imperative. So he said that a society that year after year, these are his words, a society that year after year spends more on military defense than on social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And, you know, without getting very esoteric or existential about it, our country is in a spiritual as well as economic and political crisis when so many of our resources, emotional, psychological, and scientific, as well as economic and political, are going to warfare.
Particularly when our spiritual leaders like Jerry Falwell are out there saying things like...
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops, and I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yeah.
Jerry Falwell.
Well, there's the perversion. There is the notion that we're different when we slaughter people because we use high technology from high in the air. The great Catholic theologian, you talk about religious people, rather than the faker and charlatan we just heard the voice of, Thomas Merton, the great Catholic monk and writer, said that we think mistakenly that we're better because we burn our enemies with rockets from long distances. That distinction is lost from those who are killed in their homes and their communities.
Right, but there's no cameras showing that happen.
Right.
And thus we get to ignore it. Most recent case in point, the war in Iraq. We're talking with Norman Solomon, his new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. And, Norman, you're also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Can we talk about that for a second?
Sure.
Your top three news releases, most recent news releases up there are what's behind the GM-UAW tentative health care deal, the UN gathering and private meeting with Ahmadinejad, and the Lieberman-Kyle amendment, the declaration of war on Iran. Can we just go through each one of those three? I'm curious about your take, or not just your organization's take and your guests' take, the guests that you offer, folks like us, but you know what your thoughts are on, first of all, GM-UAW. Who won? What happened? How is America being changed as a result of this?
My belief is that we're engaged as a kind of backdrop in not only warfare overseas, but a real class war here that has intensified while even naming it becomes less and less common in the media. In other words, this battle over health care is a very murky result, I believe, and shows a gradual weakening, unfortunately, of the labor movement, so that we simply don't have the power as working people that we need to develop to guarantee for ourselves and our families something as essential and basic human rights as health care.
Right. What we're seeing in the context of the GM-UAW deal and also in the context of your book, Made Love, Got War, is the consequence of 26 years of neoliberalism, 26 years of conservative economic theory, of the end of the New Deal, the death of the New Deal, starting with the election of Reagan.
Absolutely.
And a fundamental shift in philosophy, in the way that people think of the role of the United States. Do you think that by the UAW taking from General Motors tens of billions of dollars to administer their own health care program, that they will then become an opponent rather than an ally of politicians who are trying to bring about true national health care?
Well, it's hard to know, but the more that employment is somehow fused together in people's mind with the chance to maybe get decent health care, the more we move against what is essential, which is from the grassroots to develop a movement that will insist on what I think we should call Medicare for all. From the moment you are born, the moment that there is a pregnancy until death, we all have a social compact that should be honored. And if we call it Medicare for all, maybe we can get across exactly what you're referring to, is that the New Deal was beginning of a humanizing process in our society that really honored our humanity instead of turning us into these crabs trying to crawl out of the tank over others' heads. And this is about public space. It's the spirit of the New Deal, and we need to fight for it today.
Right, indeed, although there are some significant forces arrayed on the other side. For example,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I am sensing, you know, given that clip from Rush Limbaugh, I am sensing a sea change. It seems to me that they've had their 26 years and that the American people, by and large, are starting to say, no, we don't even know what the name for this is because I suppose, the Reagan Revolution or something like that. Most people, I mean, technically, really, it is called neoliberalism. Europeans recognize that word. Most Americans don't. But nonetheless, 26 years of this, and including during the Clinton administration, NAFTA, WTO, all this stuff, I think most Americans are saying, we'd really rather go back to the New Deal. We'd like Roosevelt's programs back. Thank you very much.
I agree with you. I think Americans, on the whole, they don't hang on to ideology when they see that the rhetoric and the program doesn't work for them. But it's been a long time coming. The news media, of course, have been pushing for privatization, news media largely in private hands. And really, our discussion here is in tandem on the two points. The warfare state is part of ripping off the public, using taxpayer money to enrich the wealthy and the corporations, and using the military to enforce their will on much of the world. And meanwhile, public space under attack, privatization being promoted, and profits for the few, really, in many ways, fundamental ways, to the detriment of the many.
Right. We have just about a half a minute left. We're talking with Norman Solomon, Made Love to Got War, his new book, accuracy.org. He's the director, the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. The Lieberman-Kyle Amendment. It seems to me that this is the perfect setup for the Bushies to say that they're going after terrorists by declaring that the Iranian government is terrorist.
Yeah, this is ugly, it's horrific, and it is agenda setting for war. It's laying the flagstones on the path to war. And we've got it. You know, 5 years ago, the same thing went on. This is a repetition compulsion disorder coming from Congress and the White House. From the grassroots, we have to stop it.
Yeah, indeed. And the way to stop it is?
Organize. Support media and organizing to change this militarism in our country.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well said. Thank you very much, Norman Solomon. His new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, with a foreword by Daniel Ellsberg. Norman, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Yes, indeed, just 26 years ago, about a quarter of America's workforce was unionized. Now it's down to the private labor force down to around 7 or 8%. 26 years of the Reagan war on working people in the United States. And maybe there's some pushback. We'll see. It looks frankly to me like the tide is beginning to turn. Terry O'Sullivan is with us. He is the general president of the Labor's International Union of North America, LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A. LIUNA.org, the website. Terry, welcome.
Thanks again, Tom, for having me.
Great to have you with us, Terry. It always is. You're a very insightful guy. I'm curious your take on the UAW deal. Now that the United Auto Workers is in the health insurance business, how is this going to change how the union functions? How is this going to change their relationship with General Motors? And perhaps most important, how is this going to change the face of the health care debate in the United States?
Well, I think number one, I commend the UAW and GM for coming to an agreement. It's difficult being in the healthcare business, Tom, as you know, as I know, because we're in it as well in LIUNA. And I think it was one of the things that the legacy costs needed to be addressed, and through collective bargaining, they were able to do that.
Are you guys doing the same thing? You're administering the healthcare programs of your members?
Yes, we have about 100 healthcare funds around the country for our 500,000 members. So we just don't have one national fund. We have about 100 separate. But we sit on those boards, and believe you me, the healthcare crisis in this country is destroying the middle class and affecting working families' lives like never before.
So do you think that the UAW's entry into this, they're getting into the same situation that you're in, is going to cause them to become more aggressive as advocates for a single-payer national health care program or some variation thereof, or more aggressive as, you know, since they're sitting on 20-some-odd billion bucks now, of some way to, you know, monetize that?
Well, I think, well, it sounds like a lot of money. You know, I don't know their particular dynamics. And the status of the new fund. But I know this, that even some of our best funded health and welfare funds and the laborers are going to be in trouble down, you know, 5, 10, 15, certainly 20 years from now without some sort of national health care solution to the health care crisis that we face in this country.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So, in other words, this is probably good news. What they did is they're, you know, is like we are, betting on the come that there's going to be, be more Democrats in the Congress, that there's going to be a Democratic president, and we're going to have a substantive conversation about universal health care come 2009.
From your lips to God's ears, Terry. What's on the top of your list for labor topics this week?
Well, you know, we're talking about everything getting geared up for next year and the presidential election and the congressional elections, but, you know, I've been reminding our guys and everybody that I talk to, you know, America was strongest when unions were strongest. And unions were strongest when we were a part of workers' daily conversations and daily lives. And I believe that as we march towards the presidential and congressional elections next year, that we have to get back to doing that. And in the laborers, and I know a lot of other labor unions in the American labor movement, we're talking about, you know, how we get become media savvy and do a much better job of outreach to not only to workers, the general public, and community groups, so that working people in this country aren't just hearing about us being union bosses, aren't only hearing about pickets and strikes, but are hearing about the progressive and aggressive things that organized labor is doing to improve the lives of working families.
You know, Terry, there used to be a time when there were labor newspapers in town. I remember growing up in Michigan, we had two papers, the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News. One was the labor paper, and they had a labor section. The other was the business paper, and they had a business section. What about the unions getting together and finding at least one person who would be a good daily syndicated columnist on labor issues and offering that to newspapers as a syndicated column around the United States so that we could get back to having some daily coverage of labor issues in our newspapers?
I think that's a great idea and something that we need to do in conjunction with a whole host of other things, Tom. I mean, I appreciate and my organization appreciates being part of your radio show. I mean, how do we team up with Air America and other progressive organizations to make sure that the voice of working families and working men and women in this country is being heard?
Yeah, I agree. But it needs to go even beyond that. I mean, go ahead.
We're allowing the other side to speak and actually brand us instead of us branding ourselves.
I absolutely agree with you. But, you know, our more or less 3 million listeners is nothing compared to if you could get in every newspaper in the United States. It's, you can get 100 million people or something like that. It just seems like all of us need to be reaching out beyond just this progressive measurement or progressive banner or whatever and reach out to the mainstream of America, because the fact of the matter is that the mainstream of America wants to have a union job.
Yeah, without a doubt.
They're with us.
And Tom, we also need to do a better job internally of using robocalls and text messaging and email and webcasts.
Well, and now you even got a band with the country band Whiskey Falls.
Whiskey Falls. Which is a country rock and roll band. They have a hit song called Working Man. They are members of the Laborers International Union of North America.
That's great. That's absolutely great. Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org is their website. Terry, great talking with you.
Great talking to you, Tom.
Keep up the good work.
You too. Thank you.
Indeed. You're welcome. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com.
The Tom Hartman program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
No, don't bring me down, and don't bring down this guy in Happy Valley either. Yeah, it's Stephen Howitt, 56 years old, prefers gardening in the nude. This is Happy Valley, Oregon. This is my state. And his neighbors are a little upset about that. After several complaints, the Happy Valley City Council scheduled a public meeting tomorrow night on the proposal to outlaw nudity visible from public locations. Only problem is, that's not against the law in Oregon. Public nudity on private property in Oregon is perfectly legal. In fact, there are nudist communities here. As long as the exposure is not sexual, it's not against the law. And a neighbor told the city council they asked this guy to put on some clothes while he's working on his garden, mowing his lawn, or walking around his property, but he declined their requests. As one neighbor, Mike McIrvin said, he's taking the position it's his God-given right to do that. Good heavens. I'll tell you, my mother-in-law, who lives in Oregon, has a guy who gardens in the nude in the house behind her. She just doesn't look over the fence. What can you say? 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Rick in Stockton, California. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, I really liked the exchange you had with Mr. Epstein. I think you were right on. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize the radical conservative, as you call it, the neoliberal folks, always try to label the progressives as Marxists. But the truth is, it's the other way around. The neoliberal, or whatever you want to call it, radical conservatives are the neo-Marxists, because they're people who know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And I think Michael Sandel said that. And
It's a very good quote, Rick, and well said. Thank you very much for the call. Amanda in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Amanda, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I just wanted to call and say I was really glad to hear your conversation with the last gentleman as well. I'm a labor employee, and what disturbs me is hearing so many people who are working people who have nothing but negative comments to make about unions. And then
what do you do as a union member, Amanda?
Well,
if you don't mind my asking.
No, that's fine. I'm an airline pilot.
Ah,
and,
Well,
it's interesting because I think the status in society of all labor workers has really declined. It's amazing how much more negative a view we get than we used to get.
And it's in large part because of this meme, this thought virus that was put out by Reagan, that unions drive up costs and therefore they make companies unprofitable and therefore they're destroying the American economy. When in fact, for example, in your industry, if you're as an airline pilot, Southwest Airlines is the most heavily unionized airline in the United States in terms of the total number of workers who are members of unions versus not. And it's also one of the most consistently profitable airlines in the United States.
Yeah, it's amazing. I worked for an airline that went into bankruptcy, and it seemed like, you know, the gate agents and the mechanics and the pilots, you know, we were all kind of seen as the bad guy, but we weren't the ones, of course, making the management decisions about how the airline worked. We just kind of went to work and did our jobs. But, you know, I see it so often in society. If you read USA Today or any of these other daily newspapers, all the money that gets spent on full-page ads telling us, the average worker people, how bad unions are. So I really liked your comment, too, about finding someone who could be a columnist to get out there on a regular basis just to kind of present the other side, because an awful lot of money goes into that kind of bad press.
Yeah, I really think that we need to have a labor press in the United States once more. For about 4 years on this program, we had labor news at the bottom of the hour. And it's at least on our web streams and things. It wasn't carried by all of our stations. And there really needs to be a good labor press out there. And I wish that the labor movement would pull together at least in that one area and promote that. Amanda, got to move along. Thank you very much for the call. It's good to hear from you. Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Anna.
Hey there, Tom. How you doing?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, let's see now. I wanted to tell you my new name for Congress, which is the Coalition of the Unwilling to Govern.
And yeah,
I also wanted to tell you that I've thought for some time now that the basic reason for the invasion of Iraq, the illegal invasion of Iraq, is the destruction of this country. And by the way, those people are fascists, not Marxists.
Yeah, no, I will agree with you on that. How do you think that the invasion of Iraq was designed to destroy the United States of America?
Well, when we went in, the world was trying to get in to lift the sanctions, to get medicine and food to the people of Iraq who were dying.
Right, we had 500,000 children in Iraq over an 8 or 9 year period who died as a result of the sanctions.
Plus, we had also bombed them all during those years. In fact, one general, I guess one who tells the truth, had always had said that we had run out of targets there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that had to. And then, so obviously, we could have just walked in and brought food and medicine, but we had to start a war because we had to start bankrupting this country. And while meanwhile, the corporados are moving out, where they're not going to be paying taxes, we see somebody who wants to emulate Roosevelt in one way, and that is to be a wartime president and go for a third term, I think, and be appointed to that term, not elected.
Yeah, no, I think you've got a good point there, Anna. And in fact, if you go back to Cindy Sheehan's testimony before Congress when she was speaking before John Conyers' committee, 2 years ago, and sharing the message that Mickey Herskowitz, who was hired by Barbara and George Sr. to write the autobiography for George Jr., A Charge to Keep, which is in bookstores now as George's autobiography. Mickey wrote the first draft of this, here's Cindy telling the story.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then-Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. And so I'm of the opinion that, in fact, as Anna said, part of the reason why George Bush wanted to have this war was to have the power. And not just the raw political power, but also the economic power, particularly to spread the wealth around to your buddies, of being a war president. And, you know, one of the reasons why it works so well for him to carry on this war as well. Steve in Lake Forest, Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. First of all, to the caller right after Wesley Clark, I think if General Clark used to drink the Kool-Aid and now he doesn't, I call that commendable, not being a traitor.
I really
wanted to talk about was something that I think has been completely missed in all the media from the General Petraeus testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that maybe even you could repeat this over and over and possibly dig up the audio on it. Lindsey Graham tried to throw two what I call Iran softballs at General Petraeus that he did not respond to. And I think everyone needs to know this. He asked him the first question. He said, "I assume you're still finding weapons caches in Iraq. And he said, "Are those still Saddam weapons, meaning from those days, or are you finding other things?" And clearly he's drumming up for Iran here. As I'm watching this in my mind, that's what I'm thinking. And the General Petraeus, said, "Well, sir, we really find a few of the Saddam weapons, but what we really find now are HMEs, or homemade explosives." And so then Lindsey Graham tried to really make it a softball. And he said, "I assume you're finding things from Iran then, weapons from Iran." And he actually just threw that question right at the general. And the general said, "I cannot confirm that." And I think that's one of the most important pieces of testimony that was heard over those couple of days, because here we are in the middle of all the right-wingers trying to drum up war for Iran, you know, telling us they're supplying terrorists, et cetera, in Iraq. And here the general in command could not confirm that they've even found weapons caches or anything from Iran. So I hope everybody will think about that as they're hearing right-wingers sit here and tell us we're finding all kinds of, you know, supplies coming in from Iran.
Yeah, well said, Steve. Thank you very much. Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I am a pro-union person, but I have to tell you, this $20 billion that's going to be injected into the coffers of the UAW has me concerned. The membership of that union had better become very, very active and closely guard every penny of that money, because every every vulture in Wall Street is going to come out of the woodwork and try to steal it. They're going to try to arrange all kinds of scams. Organized crime is going to try to get involved. You know the history of the union movement. Part of the reason the union movement is in such trouble is we did it to ourselves by allowing really shady and seedy people to get to take uh, control.
Well, what, you know, what happened, yeah, what happened in the 50s and 60s in the union movement, in some parts of the union movement, and Jimmy Hoffa being the most visible example of it, I think, was the exact same thing that happened in business in the 1990s. I mean, the unions were not being, there wasn't good, strong oversight by the federal government.
That's right.
And so, you know, there was a lot of money sloshing around. Some bad people got in and took advantage of it. Same thing in the 90s when Reagan stopped oversight of corporations. And 80s, 90s, and, you know, right up until the end of Enron. And I would say even now, you know, where we're seeing this whole thing with these mortgage companies, that, you know, human nature is human nature, and it's one of the reasons, as James Madison said, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, we need to be paying attention to that. But that's not, in my mind, an indictment of the union movement at all. What it says is that you need the same kind of oversight there that you have for any other kind of institution. Pretty straightforward process. And frankly, it's in place. And it has been in place for a long time. I would submit to you that the union movement now is one of the cleanest institutions that we have in American society. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
9.5 minutes before the hour, CNN is reporting that the initial U.S. government report on this Blackwater shooting, where as many as 20 civilians were killed, or perhaps murdered, in Baghdad's Nasir Square by Blackwater contractors, that the initial report, the initial, quote, government report, end quote, was written by a subcontractor working for Blackwater, paid for with your and my tax dollars. It's getting weirder and weirder. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and this, let me just back, hang on just a second, Gary. Let me just say, and therefore, as, you know, Wes Clark came on the program and he said, you know, these guys, what they're doing is legal, but it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. We shouldn't have these contractors in the field. If you've got an army out there, the army should be supplying its own security. It should be supplying its own food. It should be supplying its own mail. Why? Because if you are in a combat area, if you're in a conflict zone and the tides turn, you get attacked, you want the guy who's the cook to be able to pick up a rifle and become a soldier. You want the guy who is, or the man or woman who is delivering the mail, or the mechanic, to be able to pick up a rifle and become a soldier. You don't want your soldiers to have to be in the position of protecting the mechanics and the cooks and the guys delivering the mail all of a sudden. It's just absolutely wrong to be outsourcing military functions. It's wrong. It's not good for us. It's not good for our military. It's not good for Iraq. And then to have the company that you're outsourcing these functions to outsource the PR about what they did to another private company that's beholden to them and not to us, it's just so wrong. It's bizarre. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Two observations, if I may. One thing about Wester Clark, I really, a man of quality and a man of opinions and thoughts.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think well of Wesley Clark. I'll just leave it at that.
And secondly, it seems to me we desperately need to get back and hope we can elect a leader with a vision of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said, obviously, one of his famous quotes, "The test of progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, or whether we provide enough for those who have too little. I just don't see America moving forward unless we elect a leader who has that philosophy and get back to being a people's president instead of this anti-people president that we have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well said, Gary. Thank you very much. Dan in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
My thing is I've been listening to a lot of talk, and I'm wondering when we're going to take action.
Well, have you shown up at a Democratic Party meeting, Dan?
Excuse me?
Have you shown up at a Democratic Party meeting or a Green Party meeting?
No, I've called the Congress several times, and I've called the president.
Well, I'm telling you, we have to get active at the local level. I mean, show up at a Democracy for America meeting, show up at Google Drinking Liberally. There are these groups all over the United States. There's Screening Liberally in New York and L.A. where they actually show movies and people get together. I mean, there are so many opportunities to get together and participate. Democracy for America, democracyforamerica.com, Jim Dean's organization, Howard's brother, they actually are doing trainings. And this is a full-day training that in the corporate world, you know, bringing in high-quality trainers would be hundreds of dollars. I think it's like $25 or something to participate in a one-day training program to become a political activist. It's not enough to vote. And it's frankly, it's not enough just to call our members of Congress, although it's important that we be doing that, which is why I put up this website, callcongress.org, last week. But we also have to become activists. We have to get out there. And whether it's standing on the street corners on a Saturday with a sign that says, you know, no war for oil or whatever it may, or impeach now, or just, you know, the women in black just standing there in black and everybody gets it, you know, that we're committing horrific things around the world, or whether it's showing up at the local Democratic Party meeting. In my book, Screwed, I tell the story of three guys. One in New Mexico, one here in Portland, Oregon, and one in Denver, Colorado, who decided to show up at a Democratic Party meeting and ended up basically taking over the parties. It's not that hard to do. We can assert significant power and become the Democratic Party. And my call is far more radical than support the Democrats. My call is take over the Democrats.
Well, mine is far more radical than that. We're going against people that are willing to kill people. And all of us are sitting around with a bunch of sheep. I've gone through this before. I used to work in a steel mill, and we had some bad people there. I fought. You know how many people I had standing behind me? Zero.
That's where a union is of some value, Dan.
Oh, we were a union place. Those people that were there, supposedly tough guys, former military, former Marines. I was a former Marine. I had one former Marine. They were all pussies. They would not.
Well, Dan, I strongly recommend that you aspire to a position of leadership in all this and get active and get involved yourself at a level where you can make a difference, where you can be the guy that they're listening to. And I'm telling you, it's not that hard. Unions are, at least the unions that I've been involved with throughout my life, and I've seen a number of them. Two of my three brothers are also union members and have been for the better part of 30 years. My dad was, in a union shop for 40 years. Unions are all the time looking for people who want to rise to the top, become part of the leadership. And there are all these movements against the war and against the Bush administration all over the United States looking for good people. It's not enough just to vote and make phone calls. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Larry Sabato on his new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 Proposals to Revitalize Our Constitution, Make America a Fairer Country. Maybe a good idea, maybe not. And Special Counsel to President Clinton, Lanny Davis, is here on Gotcha Politics. Your calls and the news of the day. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.